Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to the first in a new series of conversations titled Oxford Net Zero, Climate in the Balance, which will run weekly throughout the term. First up, huge apologies for the slight delay. Technical gremlins, as expected, on the first one of these series. Hopefully we'll have them ironed out from now on, and we'll give you a seamless set of conversations. This series will take us on a wide-ranging journey across the issues and questions the world needs to tackle as we transition to net zero emissions and hence the stable climate, hopefully in an effective and equitable way. And we'll be doing so by talking to the leading lights of Oxford Net Zero. Oxford Net Zero is a new university-funded initiative bringing together experts from across departments, including geography, physics, economics, biology, law, and earth sciences, so a really wide range. And the aim is to provide key insights and resources at this critical juncture for international action on climate change. And my name is Steve Smith. I'm based at the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment, and I'm Executive Director of Oxford Net Zero. It's my pleasure to chair these conversations. Now, before we go on, I should let you know that this talk is being recorded, and also that we very much encourage you to ask questions as we go throughout these sessions. And to do so, you must be logged into Crowdcast, viewing it on Crowdcast rather than via YouTube. And hopefully, if you are in Crowdcast, you can see an Ask a Question button at the bottom right of your screen, and you can write in your question. And equally importantly, you can vote up existing questions that you like. And I'm going to do my best to ensure that we cover a good number of those before we close. Now, to help me with this first seminar, this first conversation, I'm delighted to have three other members of Oxford Net Zero, the team with me, who'll be helping set the scene with why net zero. So I have Professor Miles Allen, Kaya Axelson, and Professor Sam Fankhauser. And the way we're going to structure this is that each of them is going to talk for hopefully no more than 5 minutes. Miles on why net zero, so the physics of the climate system, which leads us to be talking about net zero in the first place. Sam is going to talk about why net zero is relevant to our activities as a society. So where do emissions come from and where are the key challenges? Where do they lie in terms of economic sectors? And then Kaya is going to talk about the why and how of net zero at organizational and individual levels. So in particular, what are the tools and information needed to drive net zero ambition and importantly, action, of course. After that, we're going to open it up to a bit of conversation and ask as many of your questions as possible to these three people. So we're going to kick off with Professor Miles Allen. Many of you will know Miles already. He is a professor of geosystem science in the School of Geography and the Environment and the Department of Physics as well. He's actually been described as the physicist behind Net Zero on BBC Radio 4 and is also the overall director of Oxford Net Zero. So Miles, hopefully your slides are going to work well and I'm going to hand it over to you.
Thank you very much indeed, Steve. I just wanted to show you a few slides which Hannah's putting up for me. Thanks, Hannah. And we'll start off with the science of net zero. Normally, the science talk is considered the complicated one, and then we get on to the sort of more straightforward stuff. But actually, when it comes to net zero, it's almost the other way around. The science of net zero is really astonishingly simple. And it's summarized by our attractive logo created for us last term. And if we go to the first slide, we could illustrate the point of this logo. The fundamental observation that underlies the fact that we need to get to net zero emissions is that it's cumulative carbon dioxide warming equivalent emissions to the time of peak warming that determine the level of temperature we end up at. So this was an insight that really came out of research in the 2000s, that it was the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that drove global temperatures, not the rate of emission at any particular year. I hope you can see the whole slide, by the way, because it's slightly corrupted on my screen, but hopefully, great, that's just sorted it out. Thank you, Hannah. So it's that sort of left-hand wedge is the is a schematic of the accumulation of carbon dioxide of emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and the reason we sort of sketched it in this way is that it's almost inevitable that a pathway to net zero will look something like this. We've got to start reducing emissions. We've got to start reducing emissions as soon as we can. And the longer we delay reducing emissions, so that the longer that round hump at the beginning of this declining pathway to net zero, the faster we have to reduce them in the future. It's analogous to the notion of a braking time. If you're approaching the stop sign, you've got a few seconds to go before you reach the stop sign. The longer you put off hitting the brakes, the harder you're going to have to brake to actually stop in time. And so that's that payoff we see between delaying now and faster reductions in the future to achieve the same climate goal. Given this challenge, it's almost inevitable, if we go to the next slide, that the amount we can reduce our production of carbon dioxide, which is the outer envelope of these three curves, the total amount of carbon dioxide we're producing from our continued use of fossil fuels, the amount we can reduce it by reducing production of carbon dioxide alone, by changing behavior patterns, electrifying transport, and so forth, won't be enough to get emissions down in time. So there's an urgent need to complement near-term emission reductions with nature-based climate solutions. So storing carbon, restoring carbon back into the Earth's biosphere in wonderful resources such as our own Whiteham Woods. The acute eyes among you may spot that's a little scene of Whiteham there. But one thing I'm doing here in this schematic, and this is where, you know, it is a schematic, but it does illustrate the big issues we need to think about on the paths to net zero, is that this process, as we move forward in time to the right of the slide, this process of storing carbon in the biosphere has an end date to it. At some point, we will reach, as it were, peak tree. At some point, our ability to store carbon in the biosphere, if we go to the next slide, please, is going to run out, because in the longer term, net carbon dioxide uptake by the biosphere must decline due to Earth system feedback. So many of the natural process systems we have that currently absorb carbon, or could absorb carbon if they were better managed from the atmosphere, will struggle to continue to absorb carbon at the same rate as the world warms. That's just due to the warming we're going to get from the emissions we're already committed to. So this doesn't, I should very much stress, and Natalie Seddon is going to be coming back to nature-based climate solutions later in this series, this absolutely doesn't undermine the importance of nature-based climate solutions. In fact, it's vitally important that we conserve and we protect natural carbon sinks in order to put off the time at which they may be degraded by warming itself. But we also have to acknowledge that the process of turning fossil fuels into trees, so to speak, just to caricature the whole thing, can't go on forever. And that therefore there's a need, if we go to the next slide, please, to scale up geological carbon dioxide storage. And that final wedge is the carbon dioxide we will need to pump back underground. If we go to the final slide, the destination we need to be aiming for is what we might call hard net zero. That's a situation in which every ton of CO2 that's generated by the burning of fossil fuels needs to be refossilized. We need to move on from changing fossil fuels into active forms of the carbon, either in the atmosphere or in the surface biosphere. And we need to essentially stop fossil fuels from causing global warming by pumping CO2 back down underground. And that's got to be our ultimate destination for achieving net zero. So that really sets the parameters, these sort of three things we need to do: reducing consumption, reducing the production of CO2 in the first place, offsetting as far as we can our remaining emissions with nature-based climate solutions, and recognizing that in the long term, we need to be moving to our geological storage of the remaining CO2 we produce as the only way of ultimately stopping fossil fuels from causing global warming. That's the scientific context in which we're working, and that's the challenge which the economists, like Sam Fankhauser, are going to have to step up to. Over to Sam.
Thank you, Miles. Just before before I introduce Sam, I'm going to take Chairman's privilege and ask you a question with a very quick response. Since you're the climate scientist in this conversation, what actually happens to the climate system when we get to net zero CO2 emissions?
Well, we get to net zero CO2, it's we're no longer seeing any carbon dioxide-induced warming. So carbon, and we then get stable temperatures. We don't see any further warming. We don't see cooling either. If you want to draw temperatures down again, you actually have to actively take CO2 back out of the atmosphere. There are other pollutants which cause warming as well. And so that's why we increasingly talk in terms of warming equivalent emissions, which is a composite of the various greenhouse gases we are dealing with that have the same warming impact as CO2. There's a technical discussion we can wander off onto if anybody's interested as to exactly how we define warming equivalent emissions. But that's the essential point, is that they have the same warming impact on the climate system as CO2 itself. And the crucial point is, if you stop CO2 emissions, you stop causing warming, but you don't undo the warming you've already caused. So the warming caused by British emissions up until now will remain in the climate system indefinitely, unless we actually actively take some of the CO2 that we have already dumped into the atmosphere back out again in the future.
Thanks, good to know. So if we're serious about stabilizing temperatures at any level, be it 1.5, 2, 3, 4 degrees, we have to ultimately reach this net zero CO2 endpoint at some stage.
We have to get CO2 emissions back down to zero.
Thank you very much, Miles. I'm gonna pass it over to Sam Fankhauser now. Now, Sam, is currently the director of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics. And many of you will know him too. He's worked at the forefront not only of research in climate economics, but also advising policymakers and businesses in many contexts. Now, we're delighted that Sam is actually going to be joining us later in the spring at Oxford to become Professor of Climate Change Economics and Policy and the Director of Research for Oxford Net Zero. So over to you, Sam.
Thanks, Steve, and let me see whether you can see, can you hear me all right? And can you see my screen, I hope? It's great to be part of Oxford Net Zero. At the moment, I'm still part of LSE, so the slides you're going to see are a combination of work that I've done in the past and some of the Oxford Net Zero themes. The question I'm going to answer, in a sense, or try to answer, is to what extent is the economics and the policy and the politics of net zero different from the economics and the policy of just climate change, as we had it for many years and many decades. The opening thing I'm going to say is that one big thing that's changed over the last, say, two years or so, is that there's now a big, broad societal consensus about the need to do something about climate change. 2 years ago or so, you had to make the case for climate action. You had to argue why it was important. You had to explain what it was. And that sort of narrative has really shifted. A lot of people now understand why climate change is important. I show you six pictures here of why the societal consensus is so broad. It isn't just the ones you're familiar with, the sort of national governments passing climate policies, or civil society, people going on school strike and so on. We also see a lot of work, a lot of interest in local communities, for example. In the UK, there's something like 400 or so local councils. Some 300 of them have declared the climate emergency, and they're starting to take actions, including very participatory things like climate assemblies and citizens' juries, as you see in the little picture of Leeds there. The courts are also increasingly taking an interest in climate change, are starting to implement the legislative basis that exists and are starting to rule on climate change. The picture you have here is of a Dutch NGO that took the Dutch government to court and won, and the Dutch government had to tighten its climate change provisions and climate change ambitions. Overall, in the world, there's something like 1,400 climate change court cases already. I will tell you another time about finance and what happened when the bishop went to the stock exchange. Let's look a little bit about the picture there in the middle of those national government actions. The picture you see there is the number of climate change laws that there exists in the world. There's about 2,000 of them. And the good news is that every country in the world is doing something about climate change. The bad news is it doesn't add up to net zero yet. The little waterfall chart you're looking at here is a piece of sort of counterfactual analysis that we recently did. And we tried to calculate how much carbon dioxide would have been emitted if there had been no climate change action whatsoever since 1999. And the answer is that between 1999 and 2016, we would have saved about 1 year's worth of carbon emissions, so about 38 gigatons of CO2. I mean, that's a lot of carbon, but it doesn't sort of make a lot of inroads. It doesn't buy us a lot of carbon space in the diagram that Miles has shown you a while ago. The waterfall also shows you here that it's about 40% of the emissions growth since 1999 has been avoided through climate legislation. Of course, that means that 60% has still happened. And that, in a sense, gets us to the challenge of net zero, the things that make net zero different from just climate politics and climate policy as we have had it. Let me give you three items that I think are particularly sort of salient for net zero. And the first one is, the first challenge is that we have to speed up the speed at which we reduce our emissions. This chart here is quite busy, but hopefully intuitive. It's also quite old, but let me quickly talk you through it. The formula there on the right tells you what determines carbon emissions in the energy sector. And it's a combination, tautologically almost, a combination of three factors. One is the amount of CO2 that we use per unit of energy, so the carbon intensity of our energy. The second is how much energy we use per unit of GDP. So that's our energy intensity. And then the final one is GDP, so our economic output. We don't want to reduce economic output, which means we have to play around with the CO2 intensity of energy and the energy intensity of GDP. You see those here on the two axes. On the y-axis, you have the CO2 intensity. On the x-axis, you have energy intensity. Each dot is a country. And you see that a lot of countries, particularly the gray low-income countries, are still intensifying their CO2 in the energy. They're carbonizing their energy sector. But most countries are to the left of the chart. That means energy intensity of GDP is improving. That's the good news. The bad news is, look at that red line there. To be on a path even for 2 degrees, let alone 1.5 degrees warming, each country, each one of those dots would have to be below the red line. They would have to have a combination of carbon intensity and energy intensity at this sort of more than 5% reduction a year. And you see there's only a handful of countries doing that. So challenge number one, speeding up the rate of decarbonization. Challenge number two follows directly from that, and that's that we have to move from the sort of sectors that we have learned to associate with climate action, with renewable energy and energy efficiency, which are in inverted commas the easy things. We have to start moving to the broader set of emissions and to start looking at the difficult emissions that we also have. You've all heard sort of words like the race to net zero or the race of our lives. If you think of net zero as a race, the electric power sector, surface transport, electric cars and renewables, they're ahead in the race. We're not there yet, but it's happening. It's starting to happen. The challenge of net zero is that we start looking at the stragglers at the back of this race. How do we decarbonize aviation? How do we decarbonize agriculture and industry? So the second challenge is to start looking at those difficult emissions. The third challenge I'm going to give you is the net in net zero. We're not talking about reducing gross emissions to zero. We're allowing for an element of offsetting residual emissions through negative emissions. Miles has talked about what those might be, a mixture of nature-based solutions like afforestation and technical solutions. like direct air capture and so on. Now, these things don't happen on their own. They don't have a value unless the government intervenes and incentivizes these things to happen. So a third challenge is, how do we give negative emissions an economic value? How do we incentivize people to produce them for us? There are various ways in which we can do that. This infographic here shows you two, and I'm not going to go into the details, but just going to tell you what the two are. You can either think of a market solution where everybody who emits a positive ton of CO2 has to buy a negative ton to sort of offset the balance individually. Another approach is that the government, through collective action, buys up and incentivizes and procures negative emissions through auctions, in the way that the government auctions renewable energy, for example. There's a lot of technical detail as to which one of those we should do. But we definitely, as a big challenge of net zero, have to make sure that the net part, the negative emissions, actually happen. Let me stop here and hand over to Kaya.
Thanks so much, Sam. So I'm going to build on much of that. I think a lot of when people ask me about my job with Oxford Net Zero, they ask a lot about greenwashing. Can we sort of trust our net zero trajectory? So I think I'll start with a moment of hope, which is that 2020 was a real landslide year for increased net zero ambition. According to Oxford and Steve Smith's and Thomas Hale's own research, net zero commitments now cover 63% of global greenhouse gas emissions and 80% of GDP. And I'm going to talk about kind of stricter criteria that we've helped to develop for the UN-backed Race to Zero campaign, about 50% of net zero targets within, or 50% of GDP covered by net zero targets is in the Race to Zero, of sort of a stricter criteria. But you know, a lot of people are concerned about the credibility of these targets. The UNEP puts out an annual emissions gap report, kind of underlying Sam's point. Many current nationally determined targets are exaggerations on what national policies are delivering, which means that we need to advocate for new policies that integrate the net zero target. Even full implementation of our current nationally determined targets still leaves our 2-degree carbon budget 80% depleted by 2030. And missing this COP26 window coming up in our option to revise nationally determined targets would make closing that 2030 emissions gap practically impossible. So it's really, really important that this year coming up is so important. There's growing but limited evidence of the subnational action, the kind of, you know, private sector, regional or city level action filling that gap. But that just shows the importance of us all doing that work, because if we begin holding our own to a high standard, that can often influence the nationally determined target process and create more ambition. So that's what we call the ambition loop, which I think brings me a lot of hope when I think about it. And I've seen it in the UK, just as the UK has set out a net zero target. I'm, you know, working weekly with the UK government to think about how we incentivize action among small businesses, among large businesses. And then in turn, those businesses, as they start figuring out their net zero strategies, put more pressure on the government to develop policies that are integrating and flowing with them. And I added this, you know, this ambition loop graphic is, I think, really inspiring. It was developed by a coalition of climate action organizations. I added one more column here, very cheekily, which is just the role of innovation and the role of research. And, you know, Systemic did a report this year that showed that low carbon solutions could be competitive in 75% of sectors by 2030 compared to zero in 2015. So that just shows you how hard people are working. The real heroes of the net zero process are, I think, the engineers and innovators who are making this possible and who are going to create over 35 million jobs, we might add, in the net zero transition. So who is in what we would call the Race to Zero, which is this UN-backed campaign to build momentum around the shift to a decarbonized economy ahead of COP26 in Glasgow? And Oxford has been really privileged to be able to help develop the criteria that have kind of created a minimum for joining this race, meaning that you have to have a more robust net zero target than sort of whatever you come up with in your kind of corporate strategy that you think means net zero. And I'll talk about that in a second. But there's 452 cities in the Race to Zero. I mean, and this is a race that started just a year ago. 22 regions, over 1,000 businesses, and growing every day. I got a message on LinkedIn yesterday from someone who had seen me speak at the Race to Zero from a major food company. And they said, "We saw you speak. We joined the Race to Zero." You know, you think you're never making an impact and you get messages like that. 45 investors, and that's growing. There's a UN Asset Owners Alliance that's growing and growing. And universities like Oxford all over the world are in the Race to Zero acting as thought leaders. So what are these minimum criteria that we've come up with? And I really have to say that it's not just been Oxford. We had a huge coalition building process by which we invited all the smartest people that we know in climate action organizations, practitioners who are actually developing net zero strategies for their business or for their city, for their region. And we brought them together and we kind of developed a four-step plan, which is much more detailed if you go to our website. But the kind of premise is that you have to pledge at the head of the organization. So, you know, maybe that's a mayor or maybe that's a CEO. You have to reach net zero in the 2040s or much sooner. And you have to set out a plan. I think what's wonderful about net zero targets is that, just as Miles said, we start from our destination, which is hard net zero, right? And then we move backwards from that. And that's unveiling all of these uncertainties that we have to deal with. Oh, we need more research and development on this aspect of decarbonization. Oh, it looks like I'm relying on the same resource as another sector. It looks like we need to pool our resources to make sure that we have alternative options and we're not fighting over the same resource in 10 years. We need to take immediate action as part of our criteria. You know, it's not enough to just say you'll push it down the line and we'll handle that in 30 years. If you're offsetting, you need to spell out how you're offsetting, which goes to Miles' point earlier. And you also need to publish your progress at least annually, including via, to the extent possible, platforms that feed into the global action tracker so that we know how far we've come. And it's not just about ambition. So Oxford has been working really hard to help people actually do the work. We've been reviewing tools that we think might be helpful to businesses, cities, regions, investors, and we have them up on a website, and that tool library is incomplete. It's not a rubber stamp on any of these tools per se, but it's a first pass to say, we think these tools are part of the solution, and we're encouraging and engaging with those tool providers to keep maintaining robust criteria and strategies that are aligned with science. So you can go over to netzeroclimate.org for explanations on net zero, for definitions, for tools. And the last thing I'll just leave you with is that, you know, no matter who you are, where you work, if you're part of any institution, if your children are part of any institution anywhere, if you have a phone, you can help in the Race to Zero. Sometimes all it takes is the right person asking at the right time to make a major organization shift its course, as I've seen in the last year. And here are just the logos of some examples of the coalitions, campaigns all working to raise ambition across universities. The Climate Pledge is a group of companies that are trying to do it what they call 10 years early. I might call it 10 years late. But it's definitely earlier than 2050. So those are all 2040 commitments. And then you've got the Business Ambition for 1.5, Science-Based Targets is working to align, and the Global Covenant of Mayors is, I think, joining the Race to Zero, along with an SME climate hub that Oxford has partnered with to help launch in the fall. So if you know any organization, ask them to join the Race to Zero and help us communicate the science that you've heard about today.
Thank you very much, Sam and Kaya, for those very comprehensive overviews, and Miles as well. I should say, for those of you who don't know Kaya, she's a Policy Engagement Fellow for Oxford Net Zero, and actually previously as a student and Vice President of the University Student Union here at Oxford, she was really a driving force behind getting the university to set its own targets for net zero carbon emissions and also to engage on net zero and fossil fuel divestment across its whole endowment portfolio. So really, really key knowledge on how this works when the rubber really hits the road. So after those oversights overviews, we're going to move to questions from you, the audience, and ask the panel members to answer them. So if you haven't already, do look in the Ask a Question section, upvote those questions you like and add your own, and we'll try to get through as many of them as possible. The first one I'd like to ask is the most popular one at the moment, and it's a great question from Philip Michelson. I think I'll ask you, Kaya, and maybe Sam after Kaya about this. Are there global standards for assessing net zero? I think, Kaya, you touched on the race to zero criteria, and perhaps that's a start, although what strikes me is that they're in a way quite process focused. And I saw, for instance, an article just this morning on Bloomberg, which was showing the amount of offsetting that some companies with net zero strategies were banking on using to meet net zero. Some from some industries, which you may say are going to have a genuine tough time to get to net zero, so perhaps they're justified in using offsets, but also some other companies who you could argue could do more themselves. So yeah, are there global standards, or what would be the way you'd think about assessing a robust net zero target and strategy?
Sure. So, I mean, you've just mentioned that one of our criteria in the Race to Zero is that you should decarbonize as far as possible before you rely on offsetting. First of all, it's going to be probably cheaper than having to invest in ultimately what we'll need for a sustainable net zero, which is geological storage options, which are much more expensive. So you might as well do the work of decarbonizing, you know, the real work of doing it in-house first. So that's one kind of principle. But then I think that there are organizations that are really great in helping other organizations set net zero targets. So I think that the SBTi is one that is looked on as a really high standard organization. You know, like every organization, I think they still have some work to do to be fully net zero aligned. But I think, and then in terms of reporting, the CDP is often looked to. But I think to answer your question fully and honestly, this is something that's in development and very much something that Oxford is helping on. We are developing standards as we go. This Race to Zero campaign is the first coordinated, you know, international campaign ahead of COP of this scale. And so sort of, I think you'll see our research come out to try to advise methodology on new standards over the next year. And I hope you'll stay tuned for that.
Sam, Miles, do you think there should be a single global standard? And if so, what do you think should be in it?
Yeah, I don't think we will have a global standard anytime soon. There will, I'm sure, be national standards, and there will be standards for particular sort of schemes or voluntary schemes or regulated schemes. The standards come in two parts for me. One is the amount of offsets you have to buy, and the other is the quality of the offsets you have to buy. Kaya sort of talked about the amount of offsets already. That's quite hard to do. I mean, as few as possible is the answer. And we will find over time that we actually need fewer than we had thought in the beginning. That's sort of my prediction. In terms of the quality of the offset, there's an important distinction between offsets that just reduce emissions, so energy efficiency offsets, for example, or sort of fuel switching offsets. They make you carbon neutral. They don't make you net zero. So we will have to move to offsets that genuinely remove carbon from the atmosphere through afforestation or similar. So net zero means the quality of the offset is carbon removal rather than just emission reductions.
And the other point to stress is that in the really big picture, we are, as I emphasized at the beginning, at some point we're going to need all our capacity for biosphere restoration just to compensate for the carbon being released by global warming itself. So we can't afford to rely on the biosphere to mop up fossil carbon emissions forever, which is why we need to be thinking about reducing those emissions as far as possible and investing in longer term storage solutions for the emissions that remain.
Thank you. And that leads us really nicely actually to a couple of other questions which have proved popular. One is, I'm interested in the panel's views on the role of soil carbon sequestration as a means of reducing atmospheric emissions or concentrations and the co-benefits that could bring to food production. Bill asked that, but also linked to that, there's a question from Bob Doherty saying, what can we do in the food system to reach net zero emissions? Obviously, soil's a critical part of growing food. And I guess the role of the food system in reaching net zero can be both emissions reductions and soil carbon sequestration and other forms of sequestration. So perhaps, Sam, given that you talked a bit about the roles of different sectors and different difficulties, you could talk about that. And then, Miles, you could talk a bit about storing carbon in soil specifically.
Yeah, thanks, Steve, and thanks for the question. I mean, land use is agriculture is firmly in the hard-to-treat category of emissions, but it's partly in the hard-to-treat category of emissions because we haven't, in policy terms anyway, we haven't tried very hard. It's quite striking that in the UK, at least, there's been a lot of regulation on a lot of emissions in the agricultural sector. It was always voluntary type approaches, and you can sort of do more in the agricultural sector by actually applying the policy tools that we have applied somewhere else. And I don't say that very often, but there is actually potentially a sort of a Brexit benefit here in that we have more degrees of freedom than we used to have under the Common Agricultural Policy. It is a difficult area because there are a lot of competing objectives around. It isn't just about maximizing carbon emissions. You have to worry about animal welfare. You have to worry about food production. You have to worry about the natural environment. So this is genuinely an area where you have multiple objectives to balance.
Yeah, I mean, soil restoration is incredibly important. Clearly, this is one of the areas where there are opportunities in the short term. But again, it's important to keep an eye on the fact that my understanding is the most important earth system feedback is, in fact, increased respiration of bacteria in warming soils. So soils could be our friend in the short term, but we need to look after them, for fear that the carbon contained in the world's soils may be released again to the atmosphere later in this century. So, that makes it all the more important to look after our soils and to look after them much better than we've been doing so far. But again, all of these carbon storage needs to become a massive industry this century, because it's clear that we are going to generate more carbon dioxide than we can afford to dump in the atmosphere and still meet our climate goals. So the really big question for the world in addressing climate change is, what are we going to do with the rest of it? What are we going to do with the excess? Where are we going to store it safely so that it doesn't remain a burden for future generations? Dumping it into the atmosphere is the worst option, because that just imposes climate risks on future generations. We're going to have to find alternatives. They all come with pluses and minuses. And that's a big part of Oxford Net Zero. It's weighing up those different options.
Now, Miles, you make a big claim there. You say it's clear that we're going to be using fossil fuels for longer than the timescale needed to get to net zero. And that might be a claim, actually, that, you know, some people might take issue with and say, well, actually, we need to get rid of fossil fuels, and we can do it, and we must do it quickly and have not just a zero carbon world or a net zero carbon world, but a fossil free world. So on what basis are you saying that it's clear to you that we're going to carry on using fossil fuels beyond the point of net zero?
Well, there's really only two alternatives. We either have to ban fossil fuels globally, or we have to, if we want to stop global warming, we have to either ban fossil fuels or decarbonize fossil fuels. We have to make sure that we fully compensate for the carbon dioxide released by continued use of fossil fuels. The idea that we might just wait for fossil fuels to become uneconomic so that people just stop using them, one day that will happen, but it could be a very long time away. And I think it's quite a risk to rely on people just moving on from using fossil fuels. So if you're counting on absolute zero, so to speak, then you are counting on a ban. Now, a ban, when the we here is important. If you're talking about we being, you know, wealthy people in rich countries, I mean, it's perhaps realistic to talk about us, and not just realistic, but perhaps ethically acceptable to talk about banning fossil fuels in the UK, fossil fuel use in the UK, for example. The Cambridge Zero reports from last year sort of set out just such a vision, but it was also commendably clear on what that meant. It meant no further aviation, no further shipping, no, you know, a lot of things changing pretty dramatically, which a lot of people, even within the UK, might take exception to. But a much bigger picture question is, can we really talk about banning fossil fuels worldwide? I think that's a big stretch. And actually, you know, I think the important way of we need to accept the way we need to frame this problem is we need to decarbonize fossil fuels by, in effect, allowing the next generation, Kaya's generation, if you like, the choice of whether they use them or not. If we don't develop the technologies to make sure that fossil fuels can be used without causing climate change, then we cut off that option entirely from the next generation. And that's really important. You know, it's not up to us to decide whether the next generation uses fossil fuels or not. It's going to be up to them. But it is up to us to decide whether we invest in the technologies that will allow them to use fossil fuels safely.
I'm sure that'd be a great point of debate we could continue with, but I must move on because there are many other great questions. Actually, Avril Aslett-Bendley asked a linked question about food, saying, how do you see the food supply chain achieving its contribution to net zero? It's a great question. And actually, it raises the important point that emissions from food are not just from food growing itself. There's a great resource, if you haven't come across it already, from Oxford called Our World in Data. And they've got a really good page pointing out that actually 6% of global greenhouse gas emissions are from food waste. And of course, it's not just the food we waste and the emissions from the food we grow directly, it's how we transport them. And aviation of sort of precious soft fruits in the middle of winter so that we can enjoy our mangoes or other fruits, our blueberries, those are all issues as well. But there's another good question as well from Edred Whittingham, which is a really good question, I think, for the Oxford Net Zero Initiative in general. What does the panel believe is the role of non-STEM graduates in getting to zero emissions? So this really touches on, is this just a science issue? We're deliberately trying to attack it from multiple angles and multiple disciplines. So Kaya, I'm sure you'd be keen to have a go at that one.
Yeah, I'm a social scientist, and I think it was very clear from the IPCC Special 1.5 report that I feel in some ways the physical scientists are handing the baton to us in that report to say, you know, we've done the hard stuff of trying to figure out some pathways here. Now you go communicate them and help drive the policies. And I think that in the past year, we've seen just the role of mass social movements to create the conditions, the political conditions. You're sort of walking through open doors now, if you use the word climate change, you know, getting into the nitty gritty details, there's going to still be debate, but that's where I think a lot of testing around what is going to become socially acceptable and what is necessary. There's still a gulf between what might be socially acceptable and what's necessary. So we need social scientists to be helping develop policies and risk assessment and engagement strategies that help us close that gap. And then also, you know, there's a lot of changing behavior that you saw the curve. There's a large curve around changing behavior that we might not want to put all our eggs in that basket, but it's definitely something that's coming. It's a wave, and we're riding it, and we're also driving it.
Right? Can I reinforce that just slightly to provoke the two gentlemen at the bottom of my screen a little bit? For me, the non-STEM subjects, the sort of the behavioral, the economic, the political skills are at this point probably more important than the sort of the science skills. Why do I say that? There's a lot of people out there who say technologically we know what we have to do. We have those blueprints. We know how one decarbonizes an economy. What we haven't figured out is how one gets societies and political systems and economies to adopt them and to do that in a rational way. And that's a social science job.
Would you like to respond to that, Miles? I'm afraid I can't hear you. Maybe you're suffering from your internet connection again. But
No, I think it was just a delay on toggling. You hear me? So thanks for
go ahead.
That's absolutely fair enough, and I broadly agree on that one. But I do want to stress one phrase that makes me feel uncomfortable Which of course was popularized by Greta Thunberg, and it's very dangerous to criticize anything coming from Greta Thunberg, but the phrase, listen to the scientists, worries me. And because nobody told me that I had a privileged position to tell the world what to do, and there's no, you know, so I think it is important that we, and I think we've seen the dangers really over recent years in, sort of technocratic, there is no alternative, you have to do it this way because that's what the scientists say, approaches to solving problems ranging from the global financial crisis to coronavirus. I mean, you know, people objecting to lockdowns and mask wearing and saying, what do these scientists, you know? Because I think it is important that we maintain the dialogue, and we're not suggesting science is done, you don't need to worry about it, just, you know, read the latest IPCC report and it will tell you what to do. Now it's just a matter of persuading people to do it. I don't think that will work. I think it's going to be up to the scientists to engage with the public and understand what they want and what's driving them, particularly in different parts of the world. We live in a very, you know, old bubble in terms of Europe and as were the coastal US in terms of our priorities. And a part of Oxford Net Zero is actually diversifying the conversation so that we're getting a broader range of perspectives in, not just from other countries, but also from other strata of society. In the UK, who perhaps haven't really engaged with the environmental conversation so much up until now, and who might be quite adversely affected by the wrong climate policies. Get climate policy right and everybody wins, but get it wrong and there will be major losers, and we need to be very careful of that.
Yeah, I wholly agree on that. I think in terms of listening to science, I agree everyone should listen to the science, but and they can expect that to provide answers about what is, but not necessarily what we ought to do about that. And that inevitably involves science plus values. So huge role for others there. And I think that links quite nicely to a question from John Matthias. Do you think that the inequitable access to resources across the globe will be a barrier to achieving net zero? Again, that might be a question you all have views on. But perhaps, Miles, I know that's something that we are hoping to address, actually, or broadly address this issue of different ways of perceiving and dealing with the net zero challenge in other parts of the world. So do you want to kick off with that one?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, for example, I can't resist the plug. I was involved in the TED Countdown series. Please go and look at go.ted.com/Miles Allen if you want to see more. But on there was, you know, one of the other, from Ruth Mutiso, one of the follow-up talks to mine was her perspective representing an organization that's all about energy access for Africa. And, you know, they feel very strongly that Africa needs energy. And fossil fuels are part of that, you know, energy mix that Africa needs to develop. And we need to engage with these conversations. And, you know, it's quite easy for us in some sense in the UK. And one of my concerns actually is the net zero conversation in the UK is very UK focused. We're all working out how to get the UK to net zero by 2050, which is fine. But if the rest of the world, if we're not helping the rest of the world do the same on a similar timescale, then we're not really solving the problem. So we need to be looking at this much broader range of perspectives, and in particular, avoiding being judgmental, particularly given, you know, after all, we started this. So it should be up to us really to show the world the way out of it.
Sam, on that point, about the UK's 2050 target, so the UK has legislated, it's said in law, it's going to aim to hit net zero by 2050. And you, of course, have direct experience because you were a member of the Committee on Climate Change. So you appointed independent expert advisors to actually really advise the government on what it should do. And it was the CCC's advice actually that really led pretty directly to the legislation of this target and the 2050 date. Do you see that as overall a good thing and enough from the UK, given that there is this inequity across the world in capabilities and in responsibility for the problem?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is actually the equity dimension is hugely important. Miles mentioned the sort of the right of least developed countries for modern forms of electricity, modern forms of energy, which has been a huge driver of development everywhere else, so that we can't switch off. That is important. We also have to worry about all those people that are worried about their jobs because they happen to be high carbon jobs. We have to help those people make the transition into new green jobs. So that's absolutely important. So that equity dimension is important. The question about the UK versus the rest of the world. I think the UK has an obligation and a self-interest to worry about global emissions, not just UK emissions. How does one do that? Step number one is lead by example. And that's we are in the process of doing in terms of the legislative frameworks we have, not necessarily yet in terms of the actions we take, but leading by example is very important. Second point is sharing good practice to the extent that we know what good practice is in this country. We can share it. And the UK has done things like that with its Climate Change Act. So sort of talked to other countries about good governance. And then the third dimension is climate finance. There's an obligation under the Paris Agreement and under the UNFCCC to provide generous amounts of climate finance over above normal financial flows to help other countries in their decarbonisation and in their resilience plans. The UK is not bad in that. The UK has quite a generous climate finance budget, one of the biggest in the world. Obviously, the UK has also just cut its 0.7% of GDP target on development aid. So it's a bit of swings and roundabouts. But those are, for me, the three things that the UK could do.
Steve, I have to jump in on this because I think that equity is only talked about in terms of net zero and in terms of climate in this one way, which is people worrying about a just transition and people, you know, putting poverty against the ways we have to address climate change. And that's just not always true. You know, I said earlier, 35 million jobs are being created by green solutions over the next 10 years. There's 10 times more green jobs in the US economy currently than there are fossil fuel industry jobs. And I think that there's so much that if we do this right, if we do this transition right, you know, we could really prosper. And there's other concerns related to equity. Anytime there's a shock to the system or a major transition, it's often the poorest people who sort of get left out of those community discussions. So, you know, it's not just about jobs, but it's also about like land use. We have to make sure that we're stipulating that in these policy transitions to net zero, we're doing community consultations. We're not just taking people's land away in order to get there. Or if we are, we're really doing it with a fair process. There's definitely concerns around equity when it comes to Indigenous communities and the way that we're going to have to use, you know, new mining materials to decarbonize. And I think these are all the kinds of questions that come into the net zero discussion that I'm hoping our new equity fellow is considering. But I just wanted to point out that, you know, equity is sometimes posed opposite climate solutions, and it just doesn't have to be. And I think we should keep that in mind.
Climate solutions are not always a cost, yes. We're past 2 o'clock, but I'm going to continue till 2:10. So those of you watching, do feel free to stay until then, given our late start. And I'm going to therefore try and squeeze in two more of these excellent questions from the audience, and then take Chairman's prerogative to squeeze in a final one of mine. So Alice Altamare asks, what is the most efficient nature-based climate solution today? I guess you could measure efficiency in one of several ways. Does any of you want to tackle that one?
I'd actually really like to punt it forward to Natalie, to the experts on nature-based climate solutions in our forthcoming net zero talk.
That feels raise right. There's one thing that I read a lot about at the moment is things like mangroves, which seem to have multiple benefits on climate resilience, on biodiversity, on emissions. But I'm sure Natalie will have many better examples than that.
That's a great plug, because that is the very next talk next week, actually. I'll be in conversation with Professor Nat Seddon and Cecile Girardin, who both work in the Nature-Based Solutions Initiative here at Oxford. So, Alice, do tune in for that one and ask your question again. It's a great question. So one more question. This is from Jim Smith. What gives you the most hope, given that the topic tends to be pretty scary? I don't know about you. This is something I find I'm asked quite a lot, actually, these days. So I am going to ask you, Sam, to have a go at that one first, and then Kaya and Miles.
There's two things that give me hope. One is something I sort of mentioned at the beginning of my talk, which is the really broad consensus across all strata of society, in the financial sector, in the business sector, at local government, in the courts, amongst civil society, that we have to do something. If you think that sort of the last general election, the slowest political party, or the least ambitious political party on climate action in the UK was the Tories, and they wanted to be net zero by 2050. That's the slowest ambition that we have in society at the moment. That gives me hope. The other bit that gives me hope is that the technological solutions to the ingenuity of reducing emissions is becoming increasingly available and increasingly cheaper. Renewables, batteries, electric cars, these things are starting to happen. So that gives me hope, but yeah, it's not going to be easy. We should be clear about that.
Kaya.
I get a lot of hope by just seeing almost how sometimes it's really hard, but sometimes it's really easy. And I think I said before, sometimes it really just takes people starting the conversation. And because we've had these environmental movements speaking up, because people are realizing, partly through the work of, you know, Oxford's research on stranded assets, or sort of the normalization of this understanding that it is economically important to align with climate solutions, sometimes you are pushing on open doors. And the more I push, the more they open and respond. And so I just think staying active and, you know, racking your brain for people you could talk to try to influence to join the race to zero, that alone will bring you hope, because, you know, it's the only way to ensure that that we're doing everything that we can.
And Miles?
I think it's important to recognize how far and how fast we've already come. I mean, I first gave a talk on the need for net zero in 2005. I kind of know exactly when it was, because it sort of, a lot of people were puzzled by it at the time. I was talking at one of the UNFCCC meetings in 2012, the one in Doha, and again, presenting the fact that we're going to have to get to net zero emissions. And at that time, a lot of the participants, even in the UNFCCC process, were quite suspicious of this. You know, it's like, you know, really, are you sure about that? Let's wait and see what the next IPCC assessment says. And that was, of course, the IPCC fifth assessment, which came out the following year and was extremely clear on this point, that we needed to get to net zero emissions to stop global warming. And within, you know, a couple of years really from then, this point was acknowledged in the Paris Agreement, and it seems to be broadly accepted in every government, in every country around the world. So, you know, in a world where everybody's wringing their hands and worrying about what happened to truth, I mean, actually, that's pretty good. That's, you know, that's pretty fast for a pretty uncomfortable scientific result to propagate through and be accepted in policy. So, you know, it doesn't mean we've done it yet, but at least we've accepted what we need to do.
Thank you, three of you. Since Miles plugged his TED talk, I'm just going to plug that in the last week, Usborne published a book for children, The Climate Crisis for Beginners, which I was involved in advising for. And I was really keen, actually, that it was a book that doesn't just give people the doom and gloom, but gives people hope, because I think that's important when speaking to children about this. But it was a real challenge. I think it's important. I hope that we've achieved it, finishing on a hopeful note. And it's not a false hope that everything's fine. I mean, we're committed to future changes, and a lot of those are really not going to be good changes. But the idea that we do have some agency in this, and that agency looks different and it probably has a different overall size for how old we are and what our roles are in society, but everyone can do something. And I think the fact that we're talking about net zero, and Kaya showed the stats on the number of people who are at least aiming for it, and we have to see the action, that is grounds for hope. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you all one final question. I'd like the answers to be as brief as possible, even though it's completely unjustified by the question. It's given we're embarking on this new Oxford Net Zero initiative, what do you see as the really big research question that needs to be tackled in order for us to achieve a global, you know, effective and equitable net zero world? So Miles, would you go first?
Well, I think I keep coming back to it's going to be all about storage of CO2. The many forms of storage of CO2. How are we going to manage it? How are we going to look after it? Who's going to own it? This is the big problem. If we leave it in the atmosphere, it belongs to nobody, and it's everybody's problem. We've got to find other things to do with it, and of course, generate a great deal less of a problem to start with.
Sam, I will ask you to tackle that one next.
Yeah, similar answer. I mean, it's sort of a quite direct question for me. What made me join Oxford Net Zero? And what excites me is two questions, really. One is what Miles has already said. How does one make sense of that need for negative emissions? How do you make economic policy, societal sense of that? But then there's also the second part, which we shouldn't forget. How do we tackle the difficult emissions that still remain so that the amount of negative emissions that we actually need is as low as possible? There's some fascinating economic, science, technology, engineering, legal, governance questions there as well.
And Kaya?
I think it won't surprise you to hear that I'm focused on impact. And so I think in the short term, the research questions that I have to do with how do we ask the right questions of the right people as quickly as possible to get them to take action. But I think long term, my questions are around a post climate era in which we have actually developed a net zero transition that involves issues that, equity questions. People often talk about climate change as if it's a cliff that we eventually just fall off one day and then it's all over, the world goes black. But that's not what it looks like. It looks like a lot more suffering for a lot more people or less suffering. And how can we use our opportunity that we have in these transitions to maybe create more distributed power to give people more opportunities through education, all the kind of co-benefits that come along with the climate crisis, which is a lot to handle all in one. And I look forward to seeing how all of our postdocs that we're bringing in help to answer those questions.
Plenty to do. So thank you very much to the three people who've joined me in conversation today, Miles Allen, Sam Fankhauser, and Kaya Axelson. And thank you to all of you for participating online as well. I'm very sorry that we didn't get the chance to cover all your questions, but fear not, because this is the first in a series running throughout the term, and we'll be touching on a lot of the topics that you're asking questions on. So the role of nature in achieving net zero, different elements of the energy system and energy vectors, and also the roles of laws and societies, not just in the UK, but around the world in very different situations. So do join us if you can. Next Monday, we'll be discussing the value and limits of working with nature to address climate change. And that will be with Professor Natalie Seddon and Dr. Cécile Girardin here at Oxford. So to register, click the green button under the video screen. And in the meantime, have a very good week from all of us. Goodbye.